Hi, everyone. I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. I really love doing these Q&A sessions. People ask such great questions, and they're fun to answer. So thanks again for the questions that you've sent. If you have questions, go ahead and put them in the chat on the video, and we pull them out of the chat. I read every question, and I'm happy to answer. So I'm going to start with ABXX7HY, who says, "Hey, John, you've mentioned that you regret not hiring whistleblower lawyers from the start. Do you think you would have avoided prison that way or changed the outcome at all? Also, what are some of the best books you've ever read? Do you have any personal recommendations? Thanks for the Q&A opportunity." Oh, yeah. You know, if I had hired the lawyers first, they would have never allowed me to enter into that meeting with the FBI. And without that meeting, I would never have been arrested. So when I tell people two things, don't ever talk to the cops without a lawyer sitting in the chair beside you, and hire the best lawyers that money can buy. I mean it. I learned the hard way. So yeah, I really believe that if I had hired a lawyer before talking to the FBI, I would never have been charged with a crime. The best books, man, there's so many. I read recently, How Can I Keep From Singing? It's the only biography of Pete Seeger, the great folk singer. Pete and I became friends toward the end of his life. I stalked the guy from when I was 18 years old. And then later on in my life, we started sort of traveling in the same circles. And he was very supportive when I got in trouble. We used to exchange Christmas cards and all. And then I thought about maybe writing a book about Pete, only to see How Can I Keep From Singing come out. And I read it, and it was so good that I could never have written a book about Pete that was that good. Wow. You know, I'm going to have to think about this because I read a lot. There are a lot of great books out there. The Rape of Nanking, I had to actually keep putting down because it was so upsetting, and then picking up again a few days later. That book came out a little while ago, at least 10 years ago, but it's worth a look. Biographies of, good grief, Joan Baez and Woody Guthrie and Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, it's like I can't get enough of biographies. I read a book recently about the history of hijacking, which was fascinating. And why did we have so many hijackings in the 1970s with everybody demanding to go to either Havana or Algiers? It was just one of those weird 70s things. That was a great book. And then there was a book published also 8 or 10 years ago now about Lee Harvey Oswald's time in Minsk, just the period when he was in Minsk, living in Belarus when it was part of the Soviet Union, was also fascinating. And it really humanized and personalized Lee Harvey Oswald, as hard as that might be. Thanks for that good question. I actually have to look at more titles because I have read so much and now I can't remember the titles, but thank you for that. Great Mosses has a question, and thank you for the donation. Great Mosses says, "John, I'm a big fan of your videos and love listening to you because you always seem like a very sincere and honest person. Thank you. So my question is, how good are you at lying, considering you worked for the CIA? You do not seem like the type that would be good at lying and manipulating people." Thank you for that also. You know, in a way, I'm ashamed to tell you that when the job calls for it, I could be a good liar. And I'm going to give you an example, an operational example. It's going to sound funny, but it's not funny. It was very serious. First of all, at the CIA, I was always the good cop. It was not my nature to use a heavy hand. I always found that if you treat people with respect and with dignity, that they're going to open up to you. And that's certainly, you know, something that the FBI teaches their people in training, not to use the heavy hand. In the CIA, they teach you how to, you know, waterboard people and torture people. It's just awful. So I never did any of that stuff. I objected to it on ethical, moral, and legal grounds. But I found also that it just didn't work. lying. I'm going to give you an example of when I lied and lied and lied and lied, but it was for a good reason. I was stationed overseas and headquarters sent me a cable saying that they wanted me to specifically target a senior Arab diplomat for recruitment. This Arab diplomat had access to technical information that our friends at NSA required. And so I managed to bump into the guy at a cocktail party. And I said, "Hey, how are you? Hi, I'm John from the American Embassy. I've heard so much about you." You know, you kind of lay it on a little bit on the thick side. And by the end of the conversation, I had invited him to lunch and he accepted. So I went to lunch. We talked and talked and talked for 2 hours. And I went back to the embassy and I wrote a cable to headquarters and I said, "He's gay." That's the vulnerability. That's what I have to try to exploit. He's gay. It was clear to me he was gay. And they responded saying, "We thought he might be gay. He was passed over for an ambassadorship," which didn't make any sense because he's quite an accomplished diplomat. And the only thing we could think of, they said, was that he's gay and closeted, and his foreign ministry knows he's gay or suspects that he's gay, so they wouldn't promote him to ambassador. That might be a second vulnerability, because if we were to pitch him, perhaps just to get revenge for being passed over for promotion, he might agree to be recruited. So I invited him to dinner, and he accepted. And he asked if I was married. I was married at the time, but I said that I was not. I said that I was single. And then I invited him to a show, like a live show. He was at the edge of his seat through the whole thing. And we strengthened our friendship. We would go out all the time. We went fishing one time. I chartered a fishing boat and we went out fishing, deep sea fishing. Did all different kinds of things. Anything he said to me in conversation that was fun for him, we did. And then one night we went out to dinner and I was saying goodbye to him and he leaned in to kiss me. And instinctively I backed away and he said, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I thought you were gay." And with only 1 second to think of a response, I said, "I am gay. I'm just not into hairy guys." He was covered in hair like a bear, and which is, I guess, what you call it. And he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." I said, no apologies. I think you're great. I'm just not sexually attracted to you." He didn't care. I recruited him, and he knew exactly what he was getting into, and he was never promoted to ambassador, but he didn't care. Because he got revenge on his foreign ministry and he got a nice big fat paycheck from the CIA. So I had to lie to this guy about who I was. I lied to him about everything about me, everything about myself. And in the end, I don't think he really cared. He knew what he was getting into. Okay, Plava K3303, thank you for your question. Plava says, "Hey, John, question for your next Q&A. Why did NATO actually bomb Serbia, Yugoslavia, and how was the perception about them in the CIA during that time? If you have an interesting story about that, please share." That's a great question. And that's something that was very difficult for me being Greek Orthodox. The Serbs are the Greeks' brothers, right? We're both Balkan people. We're both Orthodox, and to see the United States bombing Yugoslavia, specifically Serbia, halfway to the Stone Age was very, very difficult for me. I was opposed to that war from when they first used the word war or attack or bomb. To make matters worse, I was living in Greece at the time. We had to close the American embassy 6 different times and evacuate because thousands and thousands of people would descend on the embassy. And there used to be these big, fat, heavy 100 drachma coins. They're about the size of an Eisenhower silver dollar. And people would throw them at the embassy and smash the windows. So it was dangerous. The terrorist group 17 November actually killed the British defense attaché because of the Serbia war, and shot a rocket at the German ambassador's house because of the Serbia war. It was an incredibly stressful time. And I never understood the reason for attacking Yugoslavia. To make matters even worse, most of the so-called holy sites in Serbia were in the south. So if you're Serbian Orthodox, that's where all the big monasteries are. It's a very important area. Well, once the US and the UK and the United Nations redrew that map, they cut all that holy land off and gave it to Kosovo. That was an insult that the Serbian people, I think, will never get over. So why did NATO bomb Serbia? I can only speculate. It was because they believed that that the Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic was a war criminal. This was to punish him. I don't know. It was to keep the Russians at bay. I don't know. We were friends with the Russians then. But I just never understood the reason for that war. That was most definitely a war of choice. A. Al-Sadi. Thank you, John. Can you do a video about everything that is happening around Venezuela? That is a great idea. And I'm going to talk to my producer and our video and sound engineer about putting something together on Venezuela. We're at the point now where things are changing so quickly that we really should get something out. I'm going to make 2 points here on Venezuela. Number one, the day before we're filming this, on the 30th, on the 29th of October, the Associated Press reported that Nicolas Maduro's personal pilot said that he had been pitched by the CIA. Donald Trump said a couple of weeks ago that he had approved a presidential finding to authorize a covert action program against Venezuela. That is the first time in American history that a president has announced publicly the creation of a covert action program. Covert action is the most highly classified event at the CIA. It doesn't get any more classified than that. And then you have the president of the United States making an announcement to the media where I just authorized a super top secret, you know, what is it? Double secret probation overthrow of the Venezuelan government. Number one. So the idea was we recruit Maduro's pilot. And when Maduro goes to flee to Havana, instead of going to Havana, they bring him down in Key West, they arrest him, and they charge him with narcotics trafficking, even if he's never been a narcotics trafficker, number one. Number two, I have said a lot over the years that if you want to know when the United States is serious about invading another country, look at the naval movements. One of the things I learned very on in my career at the CIA during the first Gulf War, 1990-1991, is that we're not going to invade a country unless we have naval assets in the area. So I said, if we are rattling our sabers and we are not sending an aircraft carrier battle group to the region, we're full of hot air. Well, guess what? Last week, we sent an aircraft carrier battle group to the coast of Venezuela. That is an aircraft carrier and 12 support ships, including destroyers and supply ships for the long haul. So now, if somebody asks me if we're going to invade Venezuela, my answer is, I think yes. M7SNN18 says, do you believe that the US or the CIA were behind the assassination of King Faisal of Saudi Arabia? Since his nephew spent years in the U.S., maybe he got recruited or manipulated into doing it. It's a strong conspiracy theory in Saudi. I do not believe that the CIA or the U.S. had anything to do with it for a couple of reasons. First of all, King Faisal was a dear and close friend of the United States. We loved King Faisal. King Faisal loved us. There was no reason to kill him. Secondly, His nephew, the assassin, had a long history of very severe mental illness. He killed the king during an open Diwan because he was a member of the royal family. He wasn't subject to a metal detector. And he just walked right in. And I think he stabbed him, I think is what it was. I don't think he shot him. I think he stabbed him in full view of, you know, everybody in the family. So I understand that it's a conspiracy theory in Saudi Arabia. There are a lot of conspiracy theories about the United States and Saudi Arabia. But I'm confident that the nephew acted alone because he was severely mentally ill. Matthew Blair Rains 6032 says, "Hi, John. Great video. Thank you. I have a question for the Q&A. The CIA and the French services both rely heavily on paramilitary action, while MI6 stays more hands-off. Good observation. Do you think that's mainly about political culture, or does the U.S. legal framework of things like Title 10 versus Title 50 push the agency toward paramilitary action in a way that the UK system doesn't?" That is such a great question. When I was doing my speaking tour around the UK at the early part of this year, I had several conversants. So for the first five events, I had a professor of English literature from the University of London. The second five events, I had a kind of a C-list actor who hosts the UK's Home Shopping Channel. And then for my third five events, I had a retired member of MI6. He thought the speaking events would be better if we debated each other, which I hated. So he didn't work out. But we had a couple of really good private conversations about the differences between the CIA and MI6. And you hit on a very important one. MI6 does not go around the world murdering people. The French and the Americans certainly do. So we talked about this MI6 officer and I, and he said, "You know, we love the Americans and we know that you love the Brits, but we lost a lot of respect for the CIA after 9/11. We understood how angry you were. We understood that you felt vulnerable. We understood that this was the greatest intelligence failure in American history. But that did not give you the right to just start going around the world murdering people, none of whom have ever been charged with a crime in a court of law." Right? And if you're going to be murdering people, then murder bin Laden and Zawahiri and the people immediately around him, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But here we are 20 years later and you're still murdering people. It's actually 24 years later. Going around the world murdering, kidnapping. When does it end? He said, "So we work with you guys because we have to, we're supposed to, but we don't like it anymore." And I think he hit that on the head. Matt Many 4477 says, "Hey, John, I saw your short on the accountant versus the CIA agent salary." Yeah. In that clip, I said that when I went to Deloitte and Touche after I left the agency, I learned that every accountant wished he was a CIA guy, and every CIA guy wished that he made what an accountant makes. As a CIA officer who lived abroad, do they pay for your housing and utilities and give you any per diem per day? Great question. Watch all your videos. Love the stories. Seems almost odd if they didn't, for as many times as I've heard you say that you had an unlimited budget doing your job." So the answer is yes, they pay for everything. The only thing that I ever paid for overseas was food. That's it. So the State Department pays for your house, actually. So, and you have to have a house that's big enough to entertain. So for example, I was in Athens with my wife and two kids. I had a 5-bedroom, 5-bathroom house, gigantic, a mansion. I was living in Bahrain with my wife and our one child at the time. Had a 4-bedroom, 4-bathroom house. Gigantic. I had to drive an armored car. Well, I'm not going to buy an armored car. They buy me an armored car. And then we had a gas station on the grounds of the American Embassy. So I just get the gas. They give you little coupons. You just give them the coupons. You get free gas. Phones. They give you phones. I had like, I don't know, 8 phones, 1 phone to talk to each one of the people I had recruited or that I was cultivating or whatever. Everybody had a different number to call. So they paid for all the phones. You know, I was talking to my first station chief, my first tour overseas. And when I joined the CIA, hold on to your hats, I was making $17,800 a year, right? $17,800. How I had the guts to think I could afford to buy a condo, but I did somehow. So $17,800 a year. And I mentioned to my first station chief, I'm not really making any money. So it's great to have all this other stuff. I got danger pay. I got post differential 10% for the heat in the Middle East. Danger pay was 15%. And I got language differential. I got an extra 3,000 a year for speaking Greek and another 4,000 a year for speaking Arabic. And he said to me, if you spend your career overseas, you're going to be rich. He said, we don't pay for anything but food. And you save that money over the course of a 30-year career. He said, there are a lot of GS15 millionaires walking the halls. And he was right. There are a lot of guys at the agency who are not terribly senior who have loads of money because they spend their time overseas. And if you go to a war zone, you get even more money because you're not permanently assigned there. You're there on a TDY basis, temporary duty, which means you get per diem. And they changed the law, the federal law in 1991, where the old law said, whatever per diem you don't spend, you have to give back to the government. After 91, you just put it in your pocket. So let's say you go to Pakistan, right? You're expected to stay at a 5-star hotel because that's where everybody stays. That's where it's the safest normally. And unless they're driving a truck bomb into it, like they did the Marriott. And, so that's going to be about $200 a day. And then for food and incidentals, dry cleaning, laundry, you know, phone calls with a payphone, whatever, there's another $100 a day. So they're going to give you $300 a day. But I don't want to stay at the Marriott because I don't want to get blown up by a truck bomb. So I stayed at a little guest house that was $16 a day, included breakfast and dinner and laundry. I make a joke that when I got back home from Pakistan, they had to bring me my money in a wheelbarrow. I actually brought home enough money with me that I bought a house in Arlington, Virginia. So yeah, Matt, the money is outstanding. Cisco 69 says, John, big fan of your story and all of your content. Thank you. He says, keep up the great job. I was wondering, how do you keep such positive light attitude after all those who have clearly wronged you within the government? Buddy, it's not just in the government either. Also, have you authored a screenplay regarding your life and time at the CIA, or have you been approached about a film? First of all, thank you. And thank you for even noticing that. I try hard to remain positive. And I'm not going to lie to you. For a long time, I was able to remain positive with the generous assistance of venlafaxine, 10 milligrams every morning. I no longer need that, but it helped when I needed it most. But you know what, though? I have found that if I allow myself to sink into self-pity and depression, I can't get out of it. And so, you know, if I feel it happening, I go to a movie, I listen to music, I go for a very long walk, I hang out with friends, I call my sister, God bless her, and I snap myself out of it. Because otherwise, I'd be putting a hose to the tailpipe in my mouth. So better to be positive. On the Hollywood thing, I have sold the rights to my first book 3 times. The most recent time was a month ago. I have an agent and I have an entertainment attorney. I have a lot of contacts in Hollywood because as a hobby, I like to write television pilots. And over the last 18 years, I've sold 7 of them. And one of them actually made it to pilot. There's a lot of money involved, but it's fun. I just enjoy doing it. I enjoy going to LA, even when I don't have a lot of meetings to set up, because there's something restorative about, you know, blue skies and palm trees. It's incredible. Sometimes you just need to do it. A friend of mine who's a CIA psychiatrist told me one time that if you feel depressed, take a couple days off and fly to Miami Beach. And he said, studies have shown that water, blue sky, and palm trees can change your mood for as long as 3 weeks. And by then you can snap out of it on your own. So that's what I do. I have friends in Miami, friends in Tampa, family in Tampa. I'll go down to Tampa for a couple of days, snap myself out of it. I'll go to LA and visit my brother. I'll do a couple of meetings on the side. That's how I snap out of it. And at the same time, I'm confident that my situation is going to be made into a film. We're closer now than I've ever been before. I have a meeting in Washington, for example, next Wednesday afternoon with one of the producers. But we're talking about serious people. And just I'll give you as an example. Nothing came of this, but my agent was at a dinner party a couple of weeks ago, and she ran into Jake Gyllenhaal. And she said, "Oh, hey, Jake." She's known him for years. She said, "Haven't seen you around for a while." And he said, "Yeah, I decided to take a year off. I was doing a movie, two movies a year, decided to take a break and just relax. And now I'm a little pickier about what I want to do." She said, "Oh, what are you looking for?" He said, "You know, I've never done anything in the spy genre, like espionage." And she said, "Oh, do I have a guy for you?" He said, "Really?" She said, "Yeah, he's a former CIA officer. He blew the whistle on the torture program." And he says, "The guy on TikTok. I lay in bed at night and I watch that guy's videos." She calls me from the dinner party. "Would you like to meet Jake Gyllenhaal?" I said, "I'd love to meet Jake Gyllenhaal. I love his films. He's a terrific actor." And so we set up a meeting. And we got together for coffee. No big deal. Last time I was in LA. And to make a long story short, he wants to read the book, which I sent him. And my agent is going to send him the outline of a script. So we'll see. I will say that the one thing I have going against me is that there's not an end to my story yet. There's not a neat arc. And obviously, the way I would want the story to end is that I get a presidential pardon. That would really put a cherry on top of things. But in the meantime, I feel like we're talking to the right people. I'm confident it's going to happen sooner or later, and I just have to be patient. So thank you, thank you, thank you for those excellent questions. Please continue putting questions in the chat. I'm thrilled to answer them. And thanks again for liking, subscribing, sharing. Please tell your friends. The only way that we can turn this into anything is if the algorithm allows us to. And the algorithm allows us to when you like, subscribe, and share. So thanks very much. I'll see you all soon.